Go World, it's your boy Pete Walsh, episode 33 of the Respect the Game podcast. Happy New Year, everybody. I'm here with my boy Abe Schwadron, as usual.
Happy New Year, man.
Yo, you too, man. Good to see you. Not going to waste too much time. We got a very special guest today, basketball lifer, former Manhattan coach, former he coached at Providence, former Seton Hall coach, really been literally all over the world, Coach Bobby Gonzalez. Bobby, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
Peter, thank you guys for having me. I'm honored. As I said on the way in, I followed Slam my whole career, and so it's exciting to be here and do some stuff with you guys.
Cool. And then so we were talking just a little bit before we turned the mics on, and you know, you ended 2016 out in China doing some work coaching out there. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about your trip?
Well, yeah, what happened was actually Thaddeus, who you guys may know, I forgot to mention him. He's you know, big time agent with Wasserman. He has Russell Westbrook, of course, Anthony Davis. Mm-hmm. Me and Thad go way back. He's originally from New Orleans. Great guy. He called me up 2 months ago and said, hey, you know, there's this, the people in China, they saw my, I did this, I ran a camp for Five Star in August in England, and apparently they saw this thing on YouTube, and they saw me teaching and coaching, and they said, who is this guy? And they wanted to know if Thad could, you know, get a hold of me. And he goes, yeah, I know Bobby really well. I'll call him. So he said, hey, I got this gig. If you want to go to Beijing, you know, they want you to come there for a couple months and work with the national team. So I said, awesome. So I'd never been to China. I'd heard that, you know, of course, Steph Marbury and, you know, a lot of Americans are playing in the CBA out there. And, you know, I knew it was a big city and they love basketball. And so I went. I was there the whole month of November, pretty much the whole month of December. And it was awesome. Great experience. You know, worked with the top national team there. And, you know, just great, great experience. Now, not that this is breaking news or what's the word, you know, it hasn't happened. It's not official yet, but they sat me down before I left and they did verbally offer me a contract.
Oh, wow.
To come back to.
Congratulations.
They want to give me like a 4-year deal that would coincide with the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo, Japan, to come back and work with the senior national team and the top national teams. So we're in the process of looking at it. Their Chinese New Year, I guess, is January 24th or 26th to February 3rd. And so right before then, they're going to put a contract in writing and send it to us. And so I've been in touch with Thaddeus a little bit, and Wasserman would represent me on this if I do it. And so just to throw that out there, we'll see what happens. But, you know, so it's pretty interesting stuff. And I've just figured, you know, international, you can't go wrong doing international stuff. Because someday my goal might be to coach in the NBA, and you know, the international thing is a great thing to do.
Absolutely. How's the squad looking?
How's the talent out there? We actually got a very nice team. They have a, you know what happens? What I've learned by being over there is they get these guys, and of course they take them out of school when they're 15, 16 years old. They put them at a training academy, similar to like in Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them get paid and everything like that. It's almost like they're, you know, they're almost like pros. So, you know, it's like their job. They train. They come in every day and they work. And, you know, their whole goal is to win the Asia Cup or the Asia Championships or the Olympics, of course. Or, you know, that's what their big thing is, all these international competitions. And then what happens is what I learned is a lot of them don't come to the States to go to school or anything like that, because what happens is when they get really good, the CBA signs them and they end up playing in a pro league, either, you know, in China or Europe or something like that. So we got a couple guys like that right now that, if, you know, if I, you know, I'm not really looking to go back to college, but if I was, I wouldn't mind bringing a couple of these dudes with me. You know, we could win some games. Right. I mean, you know, but again, I don't know, getting them eligible and getting them over here with the language, you know, there's some barriers.
Right, right.
There's some barriers, of course.
Yeah. So you mentioned Steph Marbury, who's obviously had a revelation in China, and you probably known him since he was young, being that you have such roots in New York. So did you see him in China at all?
I did get to see Steph. It was great. You know, I went to the Shanghai Beijing game because I knew it probably the only way I could catch him, you know. And so at halftime, I went down with my translator and I waited in the hallway and he saw me and he was like shocked. He was like, Gonzo. He goes, what the heck are you doing in Beijing? And I said, Steph, I came to see you play. And I said, no, I'm here to work with the national team. Yeah. He's like, come see me after the game. But I, you know, I didn't get to hook up with him after that. The next day I had to do something. Then I flew out. But yeah, I mean, obviously he's a big hero over there. You know, they love him. You know, I see him on commercials. They got a statue of him, and you know, he's really redone his career and done a great job over there. I can't believe he's still playing. He's almost 40 years old, and he looks like he's in great shape.
Yeah,
and of course he's still a big hero. He's on the local, of course, the Beijing Ducks team, and they did win a couple championships, and so he's you know, he's a big name. They kind of call him like almost like the Michael Jordan of China over there, you know. And as I was saying to you guys earlier, you know, I recruited his cousin Jamel Thomas to Providence College, so I've known Steph since he was a young kid. You know, Bobby Hartstein at Lincoln High School was a good friend of mine, so I got a lot of history with those guys.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, you mentioned, you know, maybe you're not looking to get back into college ball, but maybe for some of our listeners, some of our Slam readers, probably, you know, the last time that they saw you coaching at least was, you know, 2010 at Seton Hall. And obviously, you know, we've talked about it a little bit before we came on air, you know, a little bit of a just a messy breakup there. So now that you've had, you know, this many years of perspective, just how do you look back on that whole thing, you know, ending, and where is that taking you now?
No, listen, it's a great question. You know, I always have to be honest about everything. You know, people like to bring up, you know, the success we had at Manhattan College, which, yeah, you know, it was great. You know, we went to two NCAAs, beat right. Florida and all that. And, you know, Gary Williams, Maryland, you know, in the NIT, you know, a couple mm-hmm. Hall of Fame coaches. And that springboarded me to Seton Hall. And the reason I went there, you know, was because I wanted to coach in the Big East. I wanted to coach against the best. So when I look back now, you know, I'm, you know, really, to be honest with you, I'm appreciative, you know, because – you know, Seton Hall gave me that opportunity. I got to, you know, coach in the Big East when I think it was in its heyday with Rick Pitino at Louisville, Jim Calhoun at mm-hmm. Connecticut, Boeheim at Syracuse. You know, unbelievable. Mike Bray, Notre Dame, Jay Wright, Villanova, you know, who's still in the Big East now. But the league then, you know, Pittsburgh, Jamie Dixon, West Virginia, Bob Huggins, John Beilein. It was so many great coaches. So when I look back, I'm appreciative I got an opportunity to coach at the highest level, one of the best, you know, programs in the metropolitan area, and go against, you know, the best coaches in the world at that time. I feel like I proved myself, you know, that I could coach at that level. You know, we had three straight winning seasons. Unfortunately, you know, everybody sort of knows the narrative that it ended bad. We had some kids get in trouble. You know, I could have handled some things differently, certainly. But when I look back now, I kind of tell people, instead of looking at it as a negative and being bitter or mad or anything like that, what I say is, listen, you know, it was a great thing for me because I learned humility. You know, I only had success up until that point in my career, mm-hmm. Winning at Manhattan, winning at Seton Hall, you know, kind of a chip on my shoulder, kind of cocky, young, aggressive guy. And I was just go to the top of the mountain. And then all of a sudden when that happened, you know, I had to take a step back, get off the treadmill and really get some perspective and, you know, look in the mirror and think about how I would handle things differently if I ever went back to college coaching or coaching at NBA or any level. And it really, you know, you learn a lot of humility. You know, I learned a lot of lessons. I definitely, you know, took a step back. I got a chance to be a husband and a father with getting married, having a daughter, buying a house, you know, kind of living the suburban life a little bit, you know, kind of, you know, getting away from basketball for a while. So I think those things for me were all very, very positive. And when I look back, I also realized that I learned a lot in how you handle the media. You know, I was a media darling, and one time everybody loved me, and then all of a sudden, you know, things go wrong and you crash. Now you're getting killed. So I kind of lived, you know, the hero and the villain.
Yeah.
You know, I've done both. You know, so I feel like I have a more mature perspective. I've certainly gotten older and changed and become a little bit different of a person now. And I think the Seton Hall situation did that for me.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I mean, it was, you know, obviously things ended unfortunately and unceremoniously, but you know, maybe it was a blessing in disguise for you. You know, you take these 7 years to reflect, and you know, but what have you been up to during this time, during this hiatus and flying under the radar a little bit?
No, good question, Peter. The first thing I did was, you know, the first year or two, like I said, I wanted to take my foot off the treadmill and take a step back, and I really wanted to study the program. My lifetime goal, I always wanted to coach college, which I did, but I always wanted to also be in the NBA someday. So I started going. Larry Brown at the time was a good friend, was in Charlotte. That was before he got fired there. He brought me down for a few weeks. I studied the training camp there. You know, I started going to Knicks practices 10 minutes from my house up mm-hmm. in Westchester. So, and Mike D'Antoni was, you know, treated me like gold there. So my first couple years out, I really went, you know, I got involved with media with Chris Sheridan, former NBA writer. I started writing columns and covering the NBA and following the USA basketball team in the Olympics. So my first few years, I did a ton of media and really studied the pro game. Then the next few years, that kind of led to a little bit of, you know, NBA scouting and some, you know, some other, you know, coaching, doing a lot of speaking engagements, clinics, you know, doing things overseas, the England thing. And that was where the China thing came from. So I think what's happened is I've learned a lot from doing media for the last 4 or 5 years, from stepping away and going to help other programs. You know, Larry Brown brought me to SMU. King Rice brought me to Monmouth. You know, good friends of mine. I would stay in the game by going to practices, watching a million games, and, you know, given my 2 cents, but at the same time, I wasn't coaching, so I was able to sort of live somewhat of a normal life. But by also being in the media, you know, you see the game from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. So really what I've done is I think I've actually, if I do go back to coaching, I think I've become a better coach because I've learned more about the game in the last 6-7 years by being away from the game than almost by being in the game, you know, because I did 18 straight years without a break. And, you know, sometimes when you do that, you know, you don't learn from other people. You don't go watch other ways to do it. You don't pick up new plays, new things. So I really think the last 5-6 years has been great for me as a coach, as a person, and as a basketball junkie. You know, I've kind of gotten a lot of different perspectives, and I've learned a lot about the pro game and all of that, and that's really what I've focused on the last couple of years.
Now, obviously, also, though, you know, the college game, college coaching, college players, even just society at large, we've, you know, moved to a totally different place from 2010 to 2017. So are there things now that you see that have changed in the college game, or I don't know, just ways that coach player interactions, coach AD interactions, are there things like that that you've noticed over these last 7 years?
It's a great question, and I couldn't agree with you more that it is incredible how much it's changed in the last 6-7 years. First and foremost, you know, when I look at the, you know, I don't want to knock college basketball and act like it's not good. I mean, you still have some very good coaches, of course. You still have some very good players. But I think what's happened is there's been a segment, a good 6, 8, 10 years of guys going one and done, you know, great players leaving early. And I think it's starting to catch up with the college game now. When I look around the country, I really feel it's very watered down. You know, the leagues, you know, are not what they were. You know, certainly the Big East is a different league now. I mean, Villanova's great, but it's not the league I was in. You know, teams that were considered like mid-majors some years ago, Creighton, Butler, teams like that. I mean, they're ranked in the top 15 in the country. Now, you know, you'll get some great players come along and they'll build certain programs, Gonzaga and things like that. But I just think that the game itself, the college game itself, is really, really watered down and nowhere near the amount of players and talent that it once had 5, 6, 7 years ago. The other thing I've noticed is the business of college basketball has changed. Certainly, guys are making a lot more money. You have this thing now called these search firms that control jobs, and now the ADs are completely different with social media. Everybody's very conservative. Everybody's worried about scandals. They're worried about lawsuits. You know, coaches have to coach differently now with social media. I don't think they can really be tough on kids these days. I mean, there's no more of the Bobby Knight, you know, sort of, you know, Mike Rice went through that thing at Rutgers. I mean, you know, like it's just a different – it's sort of a different business now. You know, young people are transferring all the time. You know, it's sort of like an instant, you know, a microwave society. Like if guys aren't starting from day one, it used to be when I was coaching, you know, guys would sit the bench for a year or two, pay their dues, and by their junior, senior year, they expected to start. Now guys are out of there first month. If they're not all league, they want to go like, they want to be like a starter the first week, you know, all league by the middle of the year and like a lottery pick by the end of the year. And if they're not, they're transferring, you know. It's like everybody wants everything now. So that's the other big thing I've learned. Just the business of it has changed in terms of the college coaches, you know, the winning part of it, and the social media aspect, and then the players, and then the talent level. You know, again, I hate to say this, there's still some great players that come along every year, of course, in college. You know, they're going to be good pros, and there's still some great, you know, you have Rick Pitino. You know, you have some middle-of-the-road guys coming up now, like Sean Miller, Tony Bennett, Jay Wright, who I think are great coaches. And then you have some old-school guys like the Boeheims and the Roy Williams and Mike Krzyzewskis that are still sort of hanging on. But overall, I just think it's a new wave. It's a new game and a new business. And it's just, you know, it's not what it once was, I think, as far as talent.
And obviously, you know, you had a couple of big upsets at Manhattan. And I always try to think about, like, how has that sort of changed for, like, the mid-major now? Not necessarily just in the tournament, but as far as those teams competing. You know, like you said, but don't those teams end up being sort of the older, more experienced teams?
100%.
Or has that changed too?
No, that's another thing that's happened. You know, when, like you said, when we were at Manhattan and we beat Florida in the NCAA, and I was like the Shaka Smart and the Brad Stevens before social media, you know, and it was just different. I mean, I was, you know, again, Mayor Giuliani, everybody knows the story. I rang the opening morning bell, the stock exchange. We were like heroes in New York. Mm-hmm. You know, Spike Lee's calling me up for the St. John's job. I'm getting offered the Miami job. I mean, it was insanity, you know. But, you know, all of a sudden, you know, now that happens, guys are instantly catapulted either in the NBA or a big job the next day. Like, it's a totally different business. Like, now if you win, you don't even have to go to the NCAA now. You just win 20, 25 games, and guys are moving up, and they're like, it's just a totally different business. But the point you made about the players, it started happening when Jim Larrañaga was at George Mason with that run that he went on to the Final Four. Remember that Final Four team?
UConn, they beat UConn in the Elite Eight.
He started, all of a sudden, you started having guys that were 22, 23 years old that had been together for 4 or 5 years, and those guys were tough and older, and they started getting against the Blue Bloods, but the Blue Bloods would have 18- and 19-year-old guys that were getting ready to go one and done, McDonald All-Americans. And all of a sudden – you know, those teams weren't such a Cinderella anymore. They started, like when I did it, we would win a game in the first round or two, and that was the big upsets then. But then it started getting to where they were breaking through the Sweet 16, getting in the Elite
Wichita
Eight.
Wichita State. Exactly.
All of a sudden now, guys are going to the Final Four. Like
Butler went to the back-to-back finals.
Shaka Smart at VCU. Yeah. Like when I did it, you know, you'd win a game in the first two rounds. That was a huge thing. Then all of a sudden, some years later, guys were going to actual Final Four and playing like UCLA, Duke, Kentucky, and Kansas to get to the national championship.
Yeah, I mean, and we've talked about, you know, we watched the, I don't know if you caught the Ben Simmons documentary that was on Showtime a couple months ago, and we talked about that at the time, too. And it's like, LSU didn't go to the tournament when the year that he was there, and he really basically said he didn't care because the NCAA tournament didn't really mean anything to him, which I guess would speak to that point. Like, some of the guys that are one-and-done guys, the tournament isn't really that important to them because they have a next step to go to.
And I look at like what Nova has done, and every year, you know, they win 25 games. It's because Jay Wright, you know, not necessarily, I mean, he would take a one and done player if they want to go to Nova.
Right.
But he builds these guys up from raw 18, 19 year olds like to, you know, senior 22 year olds who may or may not get drafted, but certainly going to have long careers playing somewhere. And like, I don't know. I just feel like it shouldn't come as a surprise that a 22 year old team who's been coached well is going to beat a group of 18-year-olds no matter what the situation is.
I know, you're right. And like you said, Jay's a great example. I told you guys earlier we won a gold medal together at USA Basketball 2005. We were roommates. He's a wonderful guy, great coach, really has it going.
What kind of a roommate is he?
Well, I tell you what was great. Me, him, and Jeff Capel, all we did, because we were in Turkey, and us in Israel never wanted to leave the campus. So all we did, you know, because of the terrorism worry at that time. But we just, what we did was we smoked cigars and talked X's and O's the whole time. But Jay is, you know, he, like I always say, he stuck up for me when I got let go at Seton Hall. He knew that I always wanted to be a Big East coach, and he came to my wedding, and he's just a wonderful, humble guy. But obviously the job he's doing, when I was in the Big East, they were fighting to get in the top eight. Now they're dominating the league. And he's got it going. You know, he's a special guy, great recruiter. Like Dennis was saying earlier, he's got that, a little bit of that old school coaching thing, but the modern, you know, with the modern style, and he builds it through having good guards. He always gets great guards, of course, and you know, like Archie Diacono last year, and now he's got, you know, Jalen Brunson, Rick Brunson's son, and I'm rooting for Jay, and he's really got it going. He's one of the model programs, you know, in the country right now, and you know, and that's his dream job. That's the thing about Jay. You know, he's had chances to leave there to go to Kentucky, Maryland, MBA, but he knows where he wants to be, and that's what, you know, I give Jay a lot of credit, you know. And you know, a lot of people come to me and say, Bobby, when you were at Manhattan, they would have built a statue of you, should have stayed there. And I'm like, I look back now, I'm like, you know, you're right. You know, sometimes you always think the grass is always greener on the other side, you know. And you look back and say, you know, you probably should have stayed there. And there's something about winning, you know. And if I had any advice to give Jay, I'd say, hey, stay right there. Don't go to the NBA. You're winning, you know. Keep winning, you know what I mean? Don't leave, you know.
Yeah, and you mentioned Jeff Capel, who's taken over for Coach K at Duke. So, you know, based on your relationship with him and you've seen him coach and know him from the past, what type of job do you think he'll do there?
Well, I think Jeff will do a great job. I know that, you know, he's going to be certainly under major pressure, but, you know, Jeff, you know, again, he played there at Duke. Wonderful guy, Jeff. You know, he was at Oklahoma, and a lot of people forget this, and he had Blake Griffin.
That's right.
And they took them to the Elite Eight. So, and he also was at VCU in the NCAA when I was at Manhattan, and we were both in the NCAA tournament together in the same building at the RBC Center. And he had a great win. They knocked off, I'm trying to think, he was at VCU, might have been, wasn't Wake Forest, because we played Chris Paul in the next round. I'm trying to think, but he had a big win. I can't remember who it was. He upset somebody. But anyway, and me and Jeff at the time had the same agent. And I think that, you know, Jeff's an experienced guy. The last two times that Coach Krzyzewski's been with the Olympic team, he brought Jeff Capel with him. So Jeff also has the USA basketball experience with Coach K on those Olympic teams like Mike Hopkins did at Syracuse with Boeheim.
Right.
So I think Jeff, you know, he's a veteran guy. He's older. He's been through the wars. He's been a head coach. He's gotten fired. You know, unfortunately, you know, he went through the thing at Oklahoma, went through his own, you know, negative baggage there at the end. It was some stuff with Tiny Gallen and some recruiting stuff, and Fuse's assistants got fired. But, you know, he's looking someday, I think, Jeff, to, you know, get back and either be a head coach again, whether it's, you know, some people think.
I think there's speculation he could take the Duke job.
You know, a lot of people always said that, you know, Mike Bray at Notre Dame or Johnny Dawkins, who was at Stanford and got let go at Stanford. And now I think he's at Florida.
Central Florida, yeah.
Central Florida. And then, you know, you have Chris Collins at Northwestern and you have Wojo, you know, Steve Wojciechowski at Marquette. And, you know, I'm probably forgetting a few guys. Jeez, I hope Tommy Amaker at Harvard. You know, you got some, you know, some former Dukies certainly doing a great job.
Quite the coaching tree.
Yeah, so I'm probably leaving some guys out. But Jeff, hey, listen, you know, Jeff's an ex-player. He's a former head coach. He's there. He's with Coach K every day. So, you know, you never know if he stays with Coach K long enough until Coach K retires. You never know. Jeff could get that nod. But I think he'll do a very good job. Of course, they got a young team. They got to handle the drama of what's his name?
Grayson Allen. The next thing I was going to ask you about.
Who, you know, of course, get, you know, suspended over the trip. And, you know, so Jeff, unfortunately, every day they're probably going to, the media is going to come in and say, when will Coach K be back? What do you think about being in his shoes? What's going to happen with Grayson Allen? What happens if Virginia Tech you lost? So, you know, I just texted Jeff yesterday to tell him I'm praying for him and rooting for him. And I hope he'll do great. And he does have some talent, certainly. And, you know, hopefully that'll get him through the players, you know.
So I'm curious how you would handle something like the Grayson Allen situation. Now, you know, having some perspective, you said you would be a better coach now. So what would you do with that whole situation if it was you?
Well, certainly similar to what Coach K just did. See, back in the day, you'd be proud, and I would probably say something like, oh, well, you know, it's my decision, and forget what the media thinks and the perception and all that. But that's not the right way to think. See, right. Nowadays, you got to say, okay, wait a minute. I'm not going to let the media run my program and just do whatever they say. But on the other hand, perception, media, you got to deal with it. You got to give the perception. You got to be fair, but you also have the perception that you're fair and that you're disciplined. So you have to do something. Unfortunately, he put the staff, or if I'm the coach there, he put you in a bad position, and you got to step in and say, hey, Grayson, I love you, but you can't do that. You had a very highly publicized trip last year, and now you did it again this year. Everybody's calling for your head. I got to sit you down. Yeah. Now, how many games you sit him down for, that's debatable. I guess it's up in the air. You know, do you say, you know, is two games enough? Is five games enough? You know, what is the punishment that fits the crime? You know, I guess that's the part that gets a little bit hairy and sort of a little crazy. And
it's interesting now, like, now that Coach K is off the bench, like, all right, so what happens to Grayson Allen? He's kind of in a little bit of a limbo period, too. I mean, I'm sure, you know, Krzyzewski's still going to be calling the shots on stuff like that. Yeah. But Jeff Capel is kind of walking into, like, okay, well, is it my responsibility to say how many games he's suspended? Like, I don't know. I feel like you have to have a strong assistance in this situation. And, you know, Jeff's been there for a long time. Like you mentioned, he's a pro. Not a pro, but he played at Duke. He's a wonderful coach. So I feel like he'll be able to handle it. But it kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, when David Black got fired from the Cavs last year and, like, Tyronn Lue had to step in. And, like, you're dealing with LeBron, like, a huge situation like that. So I see some parallels there. It'll be interesting to watch.
Well, and the tough thing, and this is what I would say to Jeff, and I haven't had a chance to say this to him, but I would say to him, Jeff, and I know he probably knows this already, I would say, Jeff, just remember that it's Coach K's team. It's not your team. You know, in other words, you work for Coach K. You make it his team. You're helping out his team. Well, because, you know, it's like Mike Hopkins when he took over for Coach Boeheim last year in the middle of the season. You can't. It's not going to be Mike Hopkins' team because Coach Boeheim's coming back. Mm-hmm. You know, Coach K's coming back. So eventually it's still his team, you know. Yeah. So you can't expect, like, Jeff really totally to just take over and say, well, you know, it's my team, so I'm going to do this. I'm going to change our defense. I'm going to change our offense. You know, he's going to have to sort of coach it. Like, what would Coach K do in this situation? Or what does he want me to do? Coach K might be watching from the hospital bed, you know, calling Jeff up on the phone saying, hey, Jeff, you know, why don't you go zone, or why don't you, change this or something, you know.
Exactly.
Something like that. You know?
And you look at the situation with Syracuse last year, like, you know, Mike Hopkins lost to St. John's last year.
Ended
up going to the Final Four. So you never know what's going to happen. You can't take it too big a grain of salt if they happen to lose their next game or whatever.
No
so,
question.
Interesting to keep something.
I always wonder, too, in situations like that, like you were saying, how, you know, you don't want the media to, you know, have a big influence on your decision-making in your program. So how much of, at least from your perspective, how much of that sort of decision making is, you know, I don't know, putting out the fire with the media versus, like, how much of the public perception are you worried about the media and general fans versus sort of your recruiting and your own players and what's going on in your own program?
Well, it's a tough balance, and it's a big part of it now because, as we said about social media, everything now is a story. I mean, it's just incredible how fast everything, you know, the 24-hour news cycles, you guys know better than anybody. So I think, you know, you have to balance it. You know, you have to sit down and meet and get behind the scenes and say, all right, you know, what do we want to do with our team? But on the other hand, how are we going to address this with the media? And what do we want to say publicly? Because you can't do one without the other anymore. You know, again, it used to be, it was sort of different, you know, but it's not that way anymore. Now it's a different world and a different business, and you've got to address it.
Because I'm wondering, like, how do you know, potential recruits, like they're always watching too, of like how certain guys get handled and what the coach does in certain situations and how much leeway the coach is giving if it's a player's coach versus a disciplinarian, you know. And like you said, like it's fragile now. Recruiting is so fragile in so many ways. So
absolutely, like this, you know, we were talking about Orlando Antigua. You know, great guy, just got let go at South Florida in the middle of the season. A lot of times, guys didn't get fired in the middle of the year when mm-hmm. I was coaching. You know, you guys got fired, of course, but it was at the end of the year. You know, okay, Orlando's been there only a couple years. He's not winning right now, but you know, usually they give you to the end of the year, that kind of thing. You know, see if you go on a run. You know, he's got some good young players, but the ADs now in the business, there's such pressure to win. It's just a different business. And then the other thing is they had an academic issue there, whether it was, I don't know, an academic scandal or whatever you call it, and his brother had to resign. So now all of a sudden, when you have the, if you have any type of impropriety going on with not winning, you're almost certainly going to get fired in this day and age. You know, you just can't, unless you're sort of a, as we were saying earlier, you know, a Rick Pitino or somebody that could absorb, you know, kind of like the Hall of Fame guys, they might be able to, mm-hmm. you know, take a couple lumps and still survive. But everybody else in the rest of the country, the most like normal guys, if they get hit with something now today in the media, they're going to, you know, they're probably going to be getting the pink slip.
Bobby, you know, your resume is extensive, and you know we've left out so much. So why don't you just take like 2 minutes just to give us a rundown where you started and just your career up until now.
Well, definitely, you know, again, with you guys, you know, with the Slam Magazine, the reason I've always followed it, and you know, and I think what ties in a lot with you guys is, you know, I started, of course, in New York City, you know, mm-hmm. coaching high school basketball and, you know, working the five-star camp with Howard Garfinkel, who unfortunately passed away.
Rest
I'm sure you guys, I'm sure you guys heard that. And of course, I was in the hospital with him, and, you know, we all went to all the guys that he helped, you know, from John Calipari and so on and so forth to, you know, all were there, you know, by his side with the wake and the funeral and the whole bit. But, you know, working the five-star camp and coaching in the New York Catholic League and, you know, talking to Dennis, who helped, you know, create your guys' magazine.
Yeah,
you know,
our publisher and Dennis Page. Yep.
Yeah, Dennis, I mean, he, you know, he was at the, I can't believe he brought up the Christ the King Tallentine game that I coached in. You know, I was the assistant coach then, you know, coaching the JV team. I forgot to mention this, Tim. On my JV team, I had Kareem Reed, who played at Arkansas, was a McDowell All-American, ended up going to St. Raymond's when the school closed. And then I had, of course, on the varsity, we had Adrian Autry, who's now at Syracuse as an assistant, Brian Reese, who's at Illinois State, Malik Seeley was there. We were number one in the country. Malik went to St. John's. Another guy, God rest his soul, you know, of course, got killed coming from Kevin Garnett's birthday party way back with the Minnesota Timberwolves. Yeah. You know, Malik was a great young man, and I knew his mother and his family well and coached him in Italy and all this other stuff. But anyway, we had, you know, we had it going, and we played Christ the King then, as Dennis mentioned, and they had, you know, Colin Reeves, who went to Arizona, and Derek Phelps, who went to North Carolina, and you know, Carl Beckett from St. John's, and Jamal Faulkner, who went to Arizona State. I mean, the Catholic League in those days, you had Jamal Mashburn and Cardinal Hayes. You had Felipe Lopez, who I got to coach at Rice for 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, you
Slam
had
Slam friend.
Yeah.
Felipe Lopez.
Yeah, Felipe. You guys have had a lot of guys that I'm, you know, close to or help recruit. We talked about, you know, help bring God Sham God to Providence. But, you know, I was at Tallentine for 3 years, then Rice in Harlem for 2 years. So if you put the 5 years in the Catholic League and then the Riverside Church and the Gaucho programs that I coached with Ernie Lorch at Riverside and Lou Dalmeida with Gauchos, and that was when the AAU was in its heyday, when there was only two big power teams in New York. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't have the Long Island Panthers and, you know, all these other, like the Broncos and like the Wrens, and like it's a different world then, you know, 25, 30 years ago. And, you know, and we would get a lot of the top players would come to Tallentine before the school closed. First it was Power Memorial and they closed. Then it was Tallentine when we closed and, you know, we were a power. Then I went to Rice and they were a power. And of course, after I left there, they had guys like Kemba Walker and great players. And then they closed. So now, you know, a lot of these schools are no longer, you know, around, you know, the Catholic schools, but you still have, you know, St. Raymond's and LaSalle where God Sham God went and some good programs. But anyway, you know, I think my roots, you know, go right in tune with you guys with, you know, being the Catholic League in New York, the five-star camp, the Riverside and Gauchos AAU. And mm-hmm. in those days, the late 80s, early 90s, that's when all these guys that are now, you know, came through the NBA, you know, and then, of course, I forgot to mention the Sonny Vaccaro ABCD camp. And I was part of that for 5-6 years. And you had, you know, I mean, I can think back. I drove the Riverside Church van to Pittsburgh 6 summers in a row for Ernie Lorch and Howard Garfinkel. And in that van, I swear to God, I could do a who's who of who was in that van, from Kenny Anderson to Ron Artest to Elton Brand to, like, I mean, Eric Barkley. I mean, I had dudes in that van that, like, a couple times I stopped in the middle of the highway ready to throw guys out and strangle some of them because they were, like, throwing things out the window. And I'm thinking to myself, some of these guys are probably going to be in the NBA someday, and they're going to remember this. But you know, certainly my you know, people forget, and that's the thing, that's the one thing that sort of I sort of feel bad and a little regretful about my career, is that when I did get to know the media and I did go through that stuff at Seton Hall, you know, they didn't really know that I had spent 25 years, you know, paying my dues, you know, at Tallentine, Rice, Xavier, Providence, Virginia, you know, Big East, ACC, Atlantic 10, the Catholic League, you know, five-star, Riverside, Gauchos. So what happens is, I think in this day and age, because of the instant media stuff, you know, unfortunately, perception becomes reality. And if you have a good reputation, everybody loves you and they think you're a hero. And if you get knocked and you get a negative thing, then that's the story that's out there. That's the narrative. So, you know, the one thing I would mention is that, you know, when I look back on my whole career and I look at it in its entirety, the 30 years, you know, I look at the whole picture and it was way more good than negative and way more good than bad. And I'm very proud of those days. And I think that a lot of the people that follow your magazine and they know the New York guy, they'll, you know, I could give them some names and some stories someday when we have more time. But yeah, like I coached at the ABCD camp, and my first team, I had Rasheed Wallace on my team, and then I had Marcus Camby during the Magic round ball game. I mean, I had guys that are now out of the NBA and retired that were literally playing for me at 16, 17 years old. And like, those are just incredible memories, you know?
Yeah.
When you mentioned that, if you've played any level of like AAU or travel basketball at all, the van scene where the coach is driving like the 12 players, you know that exact scene.
Absolutely. It's mayhem in the back.
And some of these city kids, you know, when you took them out of New York, you know, they thought they were in the Midwest when they got over the GW Bridge, you know. You're saying to them, look, man, you know, these guys never left Harlem or the South Bronx or somewhere, you know. And you're saying, look, now we're out of New York City. It's a different deal now. You know, you can't just, you know, walk into a 7-Eleven in Pittsburgh and put your arm around a girl and like, you know, you'll get arrested here. You know, like it was a different deal in those days, you know.
That's crazy.
Awesome.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about recruiting, just from a couple different angles. But obviously, you know, you were a top recruiter for Pete Gillen for many, many years. So, you know, at a couple of different schools. But, you know, the first thing, and this kind of, I thought of this a little earlier when you were talking about, you know, being able to step back from college basketball and sort of slow down a little bit. I mean, without getting into specifics, names, things, whatever, are there sort of, I don't know, shady parts of college basketball and recruiting and coaching that you're, you know, with some perspective that you're sort of glad to not deal with anymore?
100%.
Okay.
I'm not going to mince words and act like, you know, I can't answer the question or I got to be politically correct or diplomatic. I mean, listen, I'm not going to say that, you know, certainly every college coach out there is, you know, cheating and it's ridiculously rampant. But I'm going to tell you, I mean, you know, without saying names and stories and this and that,
right,
there's stuff that goes on. There's just no doubt about it. I mean, there's, you know, there's things that go on. What's kind of happened, what's interesting is, you know, 8 to 10 years ago, there was certainly people cheating and people doing things wrong and, you know, getting players eligible and you know, it basically illegally and putting them in prep schools and putting them in places and doing things academically that they shouldn't have been doing. And then there was, you know, sneaker deals or money deals or people, you know, cutting deals to get players, whether it was AAU guys or assistant coaches or, you know, like I'm proud of the fact that I never had to fire my staff or hire a high school coach or an assistant coach to deliver a player. That means something to me. Now, I'm not knocking guys that have done it. I know some guys that have done it recently and helped save their career and they were smart to do it, but I'm glad I didn't do it because I just feel like I have pride and I never had to do that. But I understand now that's not illegal, that was unethical, but guys went beyond that, guys did illegal stuff. But here's what I've learned in the last kind of 7-8 years and talking to the college guys now, what they tell me is they say, Bobby, there's still the same amount of cheating going on, maybe worse. They said, but what's happened is it's gotten more sophisticated. Now what's happening, and guys are sort of doing it through the agents or the sneaker deals, or in other words, like there's ways to get things done without the head coach of the college maybe getting his hands dirty as much, and they're sort of behind the scenes, or maybe
like
they
enough
have
degrees of separation situation.
Right, right. Okay. So that it's hard to sort of prove, you know, who did what to who and who got what for that kid to go to that school. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not trying to knock Nike or Adidas or any of the sneaker companies because I'm not saying there's not good people there trying to, it's a business. They got to make money. They're trying to get the next Kobe Bryant, the next LeBron James. And so that's a whole nother competitive thing with the sneaker companies mm-hmm. fighting over who's going to sign who and Andrew Wiggins and this guy and that guy. But let me tell you, you know, who goes to Nike camp, who goes to Adidas camp, and then who signs with what school, with what sneaker deal does that school have? Yeah. I've heard stories about people saying, well, that's a Nike school, so they're not going, you know, Adidas was not going to push that kid there, or, you know, this kid from Nike won't go to an Adidas school, or, mm-hmm. you know, there's some reality into that. Yeah. I mean, I would be sort of naive if I sit here and I wouldn't be telling you guys the truth if I sat here and said to you guys, oh, no, you know, tell all the readers and followers out there that, you know, that doesn't go on. And let me tell you something, it goes on. And, and you know, look, you know, I can't come out and prove in stone. I don't have proof of every head coach or who did what. But I could tell you that if the real truth and some of the reality ever came out with, you know, in books, if everybody could tell the truth and do a tell-all, there would be some shocked people out there with some of the guys that I think that are doing some things that everybody doesn't think those are the kind of guys that would do things. And, you know, they're doing things. So I'll leave it at that because I don't want to sound...
You're not breaking any news here. I mean, everybody everybody knows there's some shady stuff going on in college basketball. But, hey, we still love it. You know, before we let you go, we got a couple of minutes left. Can you tell us one good, I guess, clean recruiting?
that was going to be my next question. Was like, let's get like a positive, like your best get, or just a moment where you're sitting in someone's living room, something like that.
Well, I got some great ones. I mean, one that comes to mind that really doesn't have anything to do, and we didn't get the kids, so it'll be a funny story. You mentioned Ron Artest earlier, who of course met a world peace, and he could attest to this. So I get God Sham God to go to Providence College, and so Sham again is like my son. I love him. I talked to him yesterday. Me and Sham are very close. So Sham is at Providence, so he's from LaSalle Academy, of course. So he says to me, Coach, there's this 13-year-old kid that's a freshman at my school at LaSalle Academy that you need to go in and start recruiting. He says, because I'm telling you, he's going to be big time. He says, they already moved him up to the varsity. He goes, the kid's dunking. He's only in 9th or 10th grade. I'm like, really? And I'm like, who is he? He goes, they call him Ron Ron. It was Ronnie Artest. So I go, all right, Sham, well, do you think we got a chance with the kid? And he's like, yeah, you know, Miami, St. John's, Fran Fischel's at St. John's, Miami, Leonard Hamilton, everybody's already recruiting them. But, you know, I know the kid, of course. We got to get him up here for Midnight Madness, and we got to start recruiting him now as a freshman. So I said, all right, Sham, no problem. So, you know, I find out there's this kid, Ron Ron. He's from Queensbridge Projects, where Mobb Deep and all the, you know, rappers are from. And so I go in, I see Ronnie, and we start developing a relationship. And so I'm recruiting him now for like 2 to 3 years. So now here comes his senior year. So I asked Billy Aber, I says, he was the high school coach at the time. I said, Billy, I said, I know, you know, St. John's is all over him, and, you know, Ernie Lorch and Riverside, you know, probably wants him to go to St. John's, you know, even though Luke Carnesecca's, you know, retired now and Franny's there, and, you know, they're going to be tough to beat with the wheelchair game with Hank Carter and them, who's from Queens. You know, they love St. John's. And then you got Miami, who Leonard Hamilton's an assassin recruiter. Yeah. They're going to be tough to beat. I said, but, you know, we got to get the opening day visit. You got to give me the opening day. So we're the first one in the home. So Billy Aber goes, well, we're going to have all the home visits at the school. He goes, but I'll bring you guys in first on September 9th. I said, great.
Okay.
So nice. I tell Pete Gillen, I says, Pete, we got the first home visit and we got the first official visit on Midnight Madness. So I'm not saying we're going to get the kid, but we got a chance. So Sham is calling him up. Jamel Thomas, of course, is there calling him up. So I got all the New York guys helping me. So we go, we fly into New York to go to the visit that day. The meeting is going to be at 3:00. We get it. We rent a big white town Lincoln so we could pull up with class looking like, you know, these all big right, time. All right. We got our suits on and everything. So Pete says, well, Bobby, before we go to LaSalle Academy on 2nd Street and 2nd Avenue down in Alphabet City down there, he goes, Lower East Side, he goes, I want to go say hello to my good friend Tom Murray, who was coaching at Cardinal Hayes, Jamal Mashburn's high school coach, because he had given Pete this point guard who played at Xavier, was a great player named Jamal Walker. So Pete wanted to go say hello to Tom Murray. So I says, all right, Coach, you sure? I don't want to be late for the visit, but I said, all right, we'll see if we can pull it off. So I race him to Cardinal Hayes. We leave Cardinal Hayes. The Yankees have a day game.
Oh, no.
And the Yankee game lets out. And we're on the 149th Street, 3rd Avenue Bridge, and there is mayhem. There is mayhem. So all of a sudden, I'm like sweating bullets. I'm in a suit. I'm driving the car. I'm like, Coach, we can't be late for this visit. I don't know what I'm going to do. So I'm like, I'm sweating. I'm like, Coach, I go, hang on a second. I go, put your seatbelt on. I said, strap yourself in. So all of a sudden, I go into my New York City cab driver mode. I do a U-turn, right? I start going back the other way. I'm driving literally on the sidewalk. People, fruit stands are going up in the air. People are jumping out of the way. Coach Gillen had lost, like, his filling came out of his tooth from the pressure from the airplane. He's holding his mouth. He's like, Bobby, you got to get me to a store. I need Ambisol. I need Ambisol. So Pete Gillen's holding his face. I'm going. He's going down all these bumps. All of a sudden, I pull up into traffic light. I swear to God, this is a true story. It's going to go in a book someday, and it gets better. I pull up to the traffic light, and I says, Coach, let me get my phone. It's in the bag in the trunk. I said, I'll call Billy Aber and tell him we might be late. He goes, okay, no problem. So I jump out of the car at the red light. All of a sudden, I leave the car door open. I open up the trunk, and all of a sudden, I hear this scream. It sounded like, I mean, I thought a little kid got run over by a car or a dog got hit. I didn't know what happened. And I hear Pete Gillen screaming at the top of his lungs, Bobby, no. So I come around the door. I'm like, what's going on? I look, and this this Middle Eastern, not to be graphic, but I don't know what kind of nationality he was, but he a cab driver, his front bumper lodged in with our car door.
Oh.
And he's driving away, and the door is getting ready to be ripped off the hinges. And I'm and Pete Dillon is screaming. And I'm like, no, no, no. And the guy pulls away, and sure enough, the door gets torn right off the hinges, right at the traffic light. So now I go, oh, my God, what are we going to do? So we pick up the door. We put it in the trunk. I get in the Lincoln. I'm driving the car with no door. I swear. Swear to God, this is a true story. We race like a maniac. We call Billy Aber. We tell him we're on our way. We pull up in front of LaSalle High School. Ronnie Artest is standing out in front of the school with the mother and the father and Billy Aber. And we pull up with the white town Lincoln with no door on it. And we look like we've fallen out of an airplane. I mean, my tie, our suits, Pete Dillon is like, his hair is all over the place.
So missing a filling in his mouth. Yeah.
So we get out of the car and Pete goes, okay, I have one question for you guys. He goes, does anybody have any Ritalin? He goes, I need some Ritalin. He goes, I need to calm down. And they're like, where did you guys just come from? What just happened? And the greatest part about that story is that we don't end up getting Ron. He goes to St. John's, of course. And yeah. And then the PS was when we turned the rent a car in, I go, Coach, I go, I'm probably going to lose my license and have to pay like $20,000. Like what am I going to do? And the guy, I'm filling out this thing, and the guy goes, oh, don't worry about it. No big deal. Happens all the time. And I said, vintage New York. Only in New York City can a recruiting story happen like that. That's a true story. It didn't have anything to do with cheating or anything, but it's a true story. It's
amazing.
I swear to God.
And an amazing way to end our conversation.
And, by the way, when Ron sees me to this day, he comes up and gives me a big hug. And he's like one of those New York kids that I got the chance to get to know.
That's unbelievable.
Well, Coach, thank you so much for taking some time to come up today. Really appreciate it. Hope to do it again sometime
soon,
man.
Anytime.
Well, listen. If you don't go to China, the door's open.
Anytime you guys want me, I'd love to do something. And like I said, talk to Dennis about maybe doing some New York City recruiting thing down
absolutely.
The road, you know?
Sounds good, man. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me.
Great, thanks.